This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Tina Clark always knew she wanted to be in the music business, and she always knew she'd be big. She was right. Although you may not know her name, millions of music fans know her work by way of artists like Aretha Franklin and Patti LaBelle and many more. She even wrote music for Hillary Clinton's campaign. And if you ever watched the movies Hope Floats or The Five Heartbeats, then you've heard her music. Long before she was writing and producing music, she was a little girl in rural Mississippi. And she tells stories of growing up with a philandering dad and a mom who drank a little too much in her memoir, Southern Discomfort. Tina Clark is a Grammy Award-winning music producer, and she joins us now. Tina, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to see you.
What a great story you tell here. And you made a bet with your sister one day that you would be famous in the music industry, right? How old were you?
I was 10.
And why were you so sure?
Maybe it was wishful thinking, but I just at that time I was, you know, I think as I have been my entire life, just very determined. And I, even at that early of an age, all I thought about was music. And instead of, I think I was probably trying to get out of studying that day or something.
Good.
And I just made a bet with her for 50 cents. No, let's see. I can't remember. It was 10. Maybe $10 or something.
It was $10.
$10, yeah.
According to your memoir.
Yeah, it was $10. Thank you.
You can change it if you want.
Yeah, maybe it's 50 cents. No, it was $10.
It was $10.
It was big money. It was big money. And I said, by the time I'm 35, I'm going to be somebody. I don't know that I said big, but I'm going to be somebody. Mm-hmm. And I just was very driven.
Started playing the drums.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about learning to play or just picking up those drumsticks for the first time.
Well, my mother said I was even beating on rhythms on the crib. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what she used to say. I used to drive my family crazy with beating with pencils on the desk, with my hands on the back of the seat, anything and everything. I mean, it was constantly rhythm in my head. So I wanted to play the drums, and they told me that my parents said I could not play the drums because the drums were not for girls.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of like waving a red flag in front of a bull. <It's>
right.
And so I worked very hard on convincing my band director at the time because they had said, okay, you can play the clarinet. Okay, I play the clarinet. Mm-mm. You can play the saxophone. That's a little bit more beefier.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, didn't work. And so this went on and on, the trumpet, et cetera. And finally, I talked the band director into talking to my parents, and I started playing the drums.
I'm just curious now, when you're making those beats, are you actually, like, every time a song came on, or it's in your head?
Both.
You're just beating
both.
Towards it. Okay,
I
so
mean,
you got
literally,
to play the drums.
Literally, yeah. I drove everybody crazy.
And your mom actually played a part in this by building your passion for music. She used to take you on trips to New Orleans.
She did. My mom was a songwriter in the big band era in New Orleans, and she wrote with Leon Kellner, who had the famous Leon Kellner and his orchestra at the Blue Room in New Orleans during the heyday, yeah. Which it was, you know, it was an everyday thing for Judy Garland or Frank Sinatra or, you know, Nat King Cole, you name it, to be performing at the Blue Room. Sure. It was on the stop on the circuit. So my mother she never had, you know, national success, but she did have some regional, and that was her passion, although it was not my dad's passion for her to do.
Mm. And therein rested a bit of conflict and difficulty. Now, talk about that, because this memoir really covers your earliest years, your younger days as a child growing up in that family. And you are very honest about your dad's wanting to be away from the family with other women and your mother's drinking as well.
Correct.
What was that like? I mean, in your family, did you see that as a kind of a normal thing, or did you have a sense that that may not be happening everywhere? What was your sense of it?
Well, I think I would have probably, first of all, let me say that, you know, my sisters were so much older than me by 11, 12, and 15 years. And things after they all left, I was like, my mom said I was the, I always laugh about this. But my mom told me my entire life I was a save the marriage baby that didn't save the marriage. So I guess you're kind of starting out at zero.
What do you make of that?
Right. Well, you got to work really hard.
Guess.
Maybe that's why I gave myself 35 years, you know, with my sister. But my sisters were all gone and grown. And I think, look, there's no way you can think arguing and fighting and going at it all the time and in the way that they did was normal. But I think it becomes a new normal for you. And to answer your question, the reason I knew that was not the case is because I would go to my best friend's house, Burke, and, you know, when I was there, everybody sat around the dinner table and ate, and it was, and my other friends, things didn't seem like that. Yeah. We're not like that. But now, that's a disclaimer. I don't know what goes on behind those doors because right. at our home, everything was pretty on the outside.
Yeah. But not, and your mother, the drinking became, of course, progressively worse.
Yeah, my mom did not start drinking until, from what I remember and what I was told, until I was about 3. I think she was about 36. And it was social drinking. They were very much in the socialite crowd. And my dad didn't drink at all. I mean, if he had a drink, it was maybe a whiskey sour once a year at the Blue Room. But he wasn't a drinker. But my mother, I think, as I have found and as I write about in my memoir, and I don't know if it's particularly to the South, but that's all I can relate it to, is that back then and possibly now, that women did not feel like they had an out in an unhappy marriage or a dysfunctional marriage. They felt trapped. My mother was 15 when she married my father. He was 19. She had an 8th grade education. All she knew was that and raising kids and barbecues and sweet tea. And I think because, you know, all she wanted was for him to love her. But my dad was a womanizer, and he made no bones about it. To her, but to everybody else, it didn't. This did not happen, if you know what I mean. Kind of gaslighting. She had everything materialistically a person could want, but as we know, those things are not fulfilling in the end. And all she wanted was his love. So, yes, my mother, she became my hero as I got older, because I look back and think how brave she was to leave, because her, including herself and a lot of other people, they medicate. They medicate whether it's alcohol or drugs or obesity or whatever it may be. If you are settling, I found throughout this life, if you are settling and not living your truth, that truth will live you. It will come out.
It finds a way. And it is a beautiful, I think, tribute in so many ways, because you talk about those moments when, as you got older, when she was sober, there's a beautiful moment in there where you describe sort of sitting down and watching Dobie Gillis together and watching her take her makeup off.
Yes.
I mean, it's a beautiful moment because, you know, you talk about not living your truth and just that image of the makeup comes off. And of all things, Dobie Gillis, which was nobody's life, but for some reason, right. everybody's aspiration in 1959, right?
It was Maynard and Maynard?
Maynard G. Krebs, not
to
mention Zelda.
And I would beg to stay up just long enough to watch that. But my mother was a stunningly beautiful woman and one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life, and very grand. And whether she was sober or, you know, too much to drink, drunk, she had those qualities. But I would just be mesmerized as a little girl watching her put on that, what was it, like Pond's cold cream or something, and just, you know, like just cake their face, and it's like, it looked like icing on a cake.
Yeah. So I want to take you now beyond the scope of your memoir, Southern Discomfort. Tina Clark is my guest. Her memoir is called Southern Discomfort. And into your career now. When did you get started? We talked about Stevie Wonder having in some ways discovered you. How did that all play out?
Well, I was when I graduated from college, I went to the University of Southern Mississippi, and I was really wanting to leave college like my junior year and go to L.A. with the band I was in. And my dad was like, no, if you do that, I will never, ever be here when you fall, so to speak. Mm. You've got to get something to fall back onto. So I decided to do that. As soon as I finished, I graduated from college, I handed him my diploma and I said, this is yours. I'm out of here. And I had my band and I took off on the road. So I had played for several years, you know, probably 3 years on the road from like, my God, I don't know, like Louisiana to North Carolina, all on the coastlines and places. And I was also moonlighting. I was a house band. We became a house band in Biloxi, Mississippi. And so I was doing like a second job at a studio in Bogalusa, Louisiana, and as a second engineer. And that's where I met him. He was there. It was Secret Life of Plants, recording Secret Life of Plants, with a lot of people don't know about that album. But we met there, and I met his whole crew at that time. And it was just a magical time. I mean, it was so surreal that you would just have to pinch yourself. You
know? I mean, for you, because you're talking about being an engineer, this is the production side of it. Now you're listening for, you know, a little more of this, a little less of that, right? That's the real
you. Yeah, but
music.
I was really a gopher. I mean, you know, second engineers most of the time are really
What gopher. Is a second engineer in Bogalusa, Alabama, or Mississippi? Where, Alabama, did you say?
No, Louisiana.
Louisiana. You know, they're all in the deep
right.
South. And we here in North Carolina
right.
don't so closely associate.
Exactly. But y'all all do say zero the same.
We say zero.
Every person from North Carolina I know says zero.
We might could even be a little Southern, but not that Southern. So how do you come to his attention?
I guess just being there day in and day out. And he was the sweetest, kindest guy and, you know, just hung out. And I was playing at my gig one night and he came and and heard me play. And then he told one of his folks when he went back to L.A., he said to call me and tell me to come out. And so when they asked me to come out, I said, well, I don't have any money. I'm in a band. I'm working two jobs, you know. And he was like, no, I'll send a ticket a one way. And whenever she's ready to go back, she can go back. And she can stay at my mom's house or she can stay wherever I want her to hang out. So, you know, it was really a mentorship. Whether it was designed to be or not, I will be forever grateful to him because I got to spend those days and nights with him while he was recording Hotter Than July, and that was in California. And my dad, when I said I'm going to California with Stevie Wonder, and, you know, I was like beside myself. And my mother is like, they're divorced by then. And my mother is like, you know, wanting to do cartwheels. She was so excited for me. And my dad told me that he would disown me. That if I went to California with a black man, because I think he thought I was in love. All he knew was I was running off. Mm-hmm. With this guy. Mm-hmm. He didn't even know who he was. My dad knew nothing about music. So I just said, well, let me think about this. You disown me or go to California with Stevie Wonder. See ya. And I left.
Wow.
But he didn't disown me. And I wasn't with Stevie Wonder in that way.
It took off a career that really took off. And it's in many ways, I want to play a sample of at least some of the music that you are known for. Although, you know, when it's Patti LaBelle doing the song, I guess we think of Patti LaBelle.
Exactly, as you should.
But you helped create Way Up There.
Like a shooting star through endless time, we say a prayer for all. That tiny window, we would be reborn.
That's just a little tiny bit of Way Up There by Patti LaBelle, and I'm with music producer Tina Clark, who's talking about her memoir, author of the new memoir, Southern Discomfort. She's going to be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, signing books tomorrow. So what is your role in? Talk about that song. And
The Way Up There?
Yeah.
Way Up There is probably when people ask me of all the hundreds, if not thousands, of songs I've written. I would have, when they asked me what's my favorite, that would definitely be in the top three. My mother had just passed away, and which was a very difficult time. And I had been in Mississippi with her for a few weeks before she passed and was there off and on. And so I went to New York after the funeral the next day because I just needed to get away and I had work there. I was in the back of a taxi, and my assistant calls and says, Tina, it's NASA on the phone. They want to talk to you. And I was like, NASA? NASA who? I thought it was somebody's first name. You know, NASA being from the South, I mean, it's like NASA Jones, NASA. And so she was like, no, it's NASA. And I said, NASA who? And she goes, like the rockets. And I'm thinking, okay, this is some crazy friend of mine from L.A. trying to make me laugh because I've just been through all of this. Well, long story short, it was NASA. And they had called and wanted to commission me to write the theme song for NASA in the space station and the centennial flight that was happening. Well, of course, I said yes. 3 days later, I was on my way back to L.A. And before I left, I said, I was talking to my sister, my middle sister that I'm really close to, and I said, you're not going to believe this. I said, but NASA called and wants me to write their theme song for the space station and for them. And she goes, that doesn't surprise me. And I said, why? And she goes, because Mama just wants your music closer to her. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that slayed me. So I get on the plane. It was a nonstop. And I wrote the song called Way Up There on the flight to L.A.
And your sister gave you the $10.
She did when I was 35.
Tina Clark, Grammy-winning music producer, who her memoir is called Southern Discomfort. Lots more to talk about. Wish we had more time, but at Quail Ridge Books tomorrow in Raleigh, you can find out more.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us, and thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.